All right, listeners, this is the Grey Goose, and you're listening to 91.5 WGLZ. We have a very big show ahead of us today, so we're going to get right into it here with our first guest on the line. He is one of the finer musicians of the last half a century. He's had 23 gold records, 9 platinum albums, and he's sold over 100 million albums worldwide. Ladies and gentlemen, we have Tommy James with us here on the line today. Tommy, how are you today?
Well, how are you? It's great to talk with you.
I am doing great. I'm glad you were able to join us here today.
Me too.
All right, so we're going to get right into it. Tell me about your background. Where are you from?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest, a little town called Niles, Michigan, and that is where I recorded my first hit record, Hanky Panky. This is way back, of course, in the early 60s. In 1966, the record broke, and I came to New York, and the record exploded, actually, out of Pittsburgh, and I came to New York, and I've basically lived on the East Coast ever since. We signed almost immediately with Roulette Records when I came to New York, and Roulette Records took Hanky Panky to number one. And we just had a wonderful string of hit records in the 60s. And as you said in your intro, we ended up with 23 gold singles and 9 gold and platinum albums. And we did about 110 million records with Roulette Records. So I never thought 50 years later we'd still be talking about this and I'd still be performing, but that's where it's at. I look out at our concert crowd now and I see literally three generations of people, so I thank the good Lord and the fans for the kind of longevity we've had.
Absolutely. That's got to be a wonderful feeling, being able to do what you love doing so many years after you first started.
It really is. And I, you know, when I started out, of course, we never expected that we'd be going for 50 years doing rock and roll. It just blows me away every time I think about it. But you know, it's all I've ever wanted to do, and so I got, as they say, the desire in my heart, and I'm very thankful for it.
Absolutely. Who were some of your musical influences while you were growing up?
Well, my first heroes, of course, were the first generation rock and rollers. You know, Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard and Chuck Berry and all those guys who really were the founding fathers of rock and roll. And I was sort of in the next generation after that. You know, when I was I grew up I was a really young kid in the 50s, but I got my first guitar in 1956 when I was 9 years old, and it was an acoustic and then an electric guitar after that, and I just learned everything I could learn on the radio. And so in the early 60s, I started my first group cover band in my hometown in Michigan. And, you know, I just kept getting experience and learning how to play more and more music and, you know, learning what life in a band was like. And I got a job in a record shop, by the way, after school in the early 60s, where I got to promote my band out of the record shop. So I got to learn the trade papers, and I got to learn, you know, all the various labels and the songwriters and the publishers. And so I got quite an education learning retail in a record shop that went hand in hand with my experience in the group. So by the time I actually became successful myself in the record business, I knew a lot of stuff. And I can't believe how my education just kind of went on from there.
Hey, there you go. Once you first get into it,
there's no going back.
Once you're in, you're never getting out.
That's right.
So, Hanky Panky, that was your first big hit.
Very first record, yes.
How did it come about you were able to record it?
Well, actually, it was a song I'd heard another group play. And we had a little label deal with a little out. We actually had two small record label deals before I was out of high school, and it was the second deal where I recorded four songs It was in a radio studio in Niles, Michigan, on a little label called Snap Records, and that's where Hanky Panky got recorded. I heard another group play it, and I said, we got to do that. I saw what it did to people, put people on the dance floor immediately, and so we recorded Hanky Panky and three others, and it became actually popular locally back in southern Michigan, northern Indiana. And I don't mean to get too long-winded, but I'll tell you the story. It was the record kind of died after about 3 months or so, and so we figured that was the end of it. And this was 1964, and in 1965 I graduated from high school and took my band on the road up through the Midwest, and we're playing clubs in the Chicago area and up north of Chicago. And so in early 66, I'm playing this dumpy little club in Janesville, Wisconsin, and right in the middle of my 2 weeks, the guy got shut down by the IRS for not paying his taxes. So we got sent home, and feeling really like losers, and I go back to Niles, Michigan. But that's as soon as I got home, I got the call that changed my life. One copy of the record, Hanky Panky, from 2 years earlier, somehow got in the record bin in Pittsburgh. And they picked it up out of a record bin and played it on dances and then played it on the radio, and the switchboard lit up, and suddenly we had a hit in Pittsburgh, and they bootlegged 80,000 copies of them, of this record, on Snap Records. And sold them sold 80,000 of them in 10 days.
Wow.
And so we were sitting at number one in Pittsburgh, and they called me at that moment. They tracked me down, and if I hadn't have been home, you and I wouldn't be talking today. If I hadn't have been home to get that call, that was the call that changed my life, that Hanky Panky was number one in the city of Pittsburgh. And I went to Pittsburgh, and I couldn't put the original band back together, so I went to a club, and I saw a group playing, and I sort of grabbed the first club band that I could find that I really liked to be the Shondells. And I asked them if they wanted to be the Shondells, and they said, yeah. And we all went to New York a week later, and that's when we sold the record to Ouellette. But that was just like, it was a crazy story, only in America. You know, one of those homegrown stories that probably couldn't happen again today.
Absolutely. Things like that, it just doesn't happen today.
No.
1960s, that was a different time.
Yes, it was. And all the ducks were in a row, and everybody was looking for the next big group. And so things like that, only happened in the 60s.
Absolutely. So when you went to New York, you ended up signing with Ouellette Records.
That's right, and that was a whole story unto itself. In fact, we wrote a book about it. I tell the story in our book, Me, the Mob, and the Music, when I went to New York, we got a yes from all the major labels. We got a yes from Columbia, from RCA, we got, Atlantic, Kamasutra, and finally the last place we took it to was Ouellette. And we had just gotten a yes from all the big corporate labels, and I was feeling really great. And that night I go to sleep at a hotel in New York, and thinking we're probably going to go with CBS or RCA. And so the next morning, about 9:30, all the record companies that had said yes the day before suddenly called up and they said no. Said, sorry, we got a pass. And I said, what do you mean you got a pass? I thought we had a deal. And finally, Jerry Wexler at Atlantic Records told me the truth, that Morris Levy, the head of Ouellette Records, who was known for being sort of a mobster, called up all the other labels and said, back off, this is my artist. and they did. And so that was the first offer we couldn't refuse from Morris Levy. And honestly, he scared all the other record companies off, and we were apparently going to be on roulette. So what we came to learn, of course, as time went on, we signed with roulette, and what we came to learn was that Roulette Records, in addition to being a good little independent label, which had had a lot of hits over the past and took our record to number one, was also a front for the Genovese crime family in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no idea of this when we signed. We learned it, you know, over time. And so this was just incredible that, and we couldn't talk about it. This is something we just could not talk about. And so we had to make a lot of decisions. You know, do we try to get off the label? Do we, you know, what do we do? I'm glad we ended up sticking it out because now I get to tell the story. But it was Roulette Records, and they did great for us, but we just, of course, couldn't get paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be an issue.
Yes, that was the big problem. We were making money from all the other areas, you know, from concerts and from radio airplay, from BMI and all that stuff. But as far as mechanical royalties were, it just wasn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So you end up being at Roulette for a number of years, and that's where the majority of your major hits came out at.
That's true. And you know, we as soon as Hanky Panky hit, then we had Say I Am, and then I Think We're Alone Now, and Money Money, and Getting Together, and Crimson and Clover, and just all the rest, it was in a row. We had, and they were straight hits too. There weren't any, you know, dips on the radar screen. It wasn't like we had one every three or four records. We had them all in a row,
mm-hmm.
And it was really quite amazing. We had an amazing run at Roulette, and so there's a lot. As I told you before, I wrote a book about it,
mm-hmm.
called Me, the Mob, and the Music, which really documents the whole. It's an autobiography with about two thirds of the book devoted to our very crazy relationship with Roulette, and often scary,
mm-hmm.
because you know, it was run by the mob.
Yeah,
and so. You know, we had a choice. We could leave and take our life in our hands, or we could stay and stick it out. And I'm sure glad we did, because I think, you know, Roulette, they actually needed us. If we had gone with one of the big labels, with CBS or RCA, especially with a record like Hanky Panky, I can tell you right now, we would have been handed over to some in-house A&R guy, and that's probably the last time anybody would have heard of us.
Mm-hmm.
We would have been lucky to have been a one-hit wonder. At Roulette, they actually needed us.
Yeah.
And so we got the keys to the candy store, but we also didn't get the royalties. So, you know, it was a double-edged sword.
Yeah. It's truly a shame that things had to work out that way.
Well, thankfully, we got most of it back, a good chunk of it back over the years. But
mm-hmm.
That's the way it was at first.
Now, I've read the autobiography, by the way, and I think it was a wonderful book.
Thank you very much.
And
it's going to be a movie now, you know.
I'm looking forward to watching it whenever it comes out.
Me too. Well, the movie is, you know, as soon as we released the book, we got immediate response from Broadway and the film industry. Immediately start getting calls for the rights to the film and for the rights as a Broadway musical, and so we're going to do the movie first, and it's going to be produced by Barbara DeFina, who produced Goodfellas and Casino and Hugo a couple of years ago with Martin Scorsese, and just a string of great movies. And we're very honored and flattered that she's going to produce the film. And the screenplay has been written by Matthew Stone, and he's a brilliant screenplay writer. And so I'm getting an amazing education here. It's the first film we've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're probably looking at another 2 years. You know, everyone who comes on board is another negotiation and, you know, another ego and another schedule to take into consideration. It's really amazing any movie ever gets made.
It really is. I mean, it's a very long-winded process. A lot of people just don't realize it.
It's true. And then, of course, the casting. And it's very, very involved. I'm going to be a technical advisor on the film as well as one of the producers.
Very nice.
But I'm very happy that they're sticking to the story and not, you know, taking a lot of liberties with it.
Any idea who's going to play you yet?
I get asked that all the time. I'm... It's way over my head. This is one time I got to let the grown-ups run the show because I have no idea. It's got to be somebody who plays guitar as badly as I do. That's the only prerequisite.
All righty. Who would you like to see play you?
Oh, God. How about Walter Brennan? I have no idea. All I know is it won't be me. Truthfully, it's way over my head. There's so many great young actors. You know, the funny part is Jamie Foxx really ruined it for everybody when he did the movie Ray, because he was so good. And he actually did the singing.
Yeah.
And he sang like Ray, and he sounded like Ray, and you as you got into the movie, you know, he became Ray. And so there's no more lip syncing and no more, you know, whoever it is going to have to actually do the singing and play the guitar and really be good. And of course Morris Levy is who is the head of Roulette Records, because that's really the story, is about Morris and myself. That's really the story. This you know, this odd couple, you know, this New York gangster and this hick kid from the Midwest, teaming up and actually having it work. But it was almost like an abusive father-son relationship, you know. It's like the guy who, you know, slaps the kid around, but he sends him to college, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's going to be a really interesting combination of characters, and who we get from Morris Levy is going to be very important. You know, Morris really is the star of the show.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It's not me, it's Morris. So it's going to be interesting. Going to be interesting couple of years. We're probably looking at another 2 years.
Alrighty. Well, I'll be looking forward to it, as well as I'm sure a lot of other people will be as well.
Well, thank you very much.
No problem. So let's see. What is the music process like for when you're writing new music?
Well, you know, it's funny because we're in the middle of doing a new album right now. And this is an album. It's called Alive. That's the name of the album. And it'll be out the first quarter of next year. And it's my first studio album in 10 years. And so it's going to be a combination of a lot of things. Two of the songs are actually going to be from the movie.
Oh, wow.
One is a brand new version of I Think We're Alone Now, which is slow and acoustic and it's totally different from the original record. And it's going to be used over the closing credits of the film. And I'm very proud of this record because it's just me and the acoustic guitar. It could end up being a single, too. We're not sure. But the other song is called Distant Thunder, and it's the last song that Morris Levy and I agreed on but before he got arrested and ultimately died. So this is there are two songs on the album that will almost certainly be in the movie, and then all new songs. So it's going to be it's a really interesting album that a lot of love went into.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always nice when you see a musician that's truly dedicated to his craft.
Well, I agree, and I you know, it's not like I've ever wanted to do anything else, and I am very, very blessed to be doing it for this long. I never in a million years thought we would be, you know, starting out with a record like Hanky Panky, we'd be doing this for 50 years.
Absolutely. You've had a truly marvelous career, so it has
well,
to be
you.
It has to be rewarding to be able to look back on it and just see what you've accomplished.
Well, I it's amazing. I am so grateful to be doing this long, and it's all I ever wanted to do. But also, just because rock and roll is usually an industry that's so short-lived, you know, you're lucky to get 2 years.
Yeah.
In the major leagues, you're lucky to get 2, maybe 3 years if you score. And so, man, it's wild, and I mean it. I look out at our crowd now, there's 3 generations of people. And they don't know each other, but they all know the music, you know. And when we do new stuff in the show, you know, I like to preview stuff in the show that we're going to do on record. Not a lot of stuff because people want to hear the hits, but... like we do the new version of I Think We're Alone Now, and next year we're going to start doing Distant Thunder from the album, and that's going to be a part of the show. And so, you know, the funny part, too, is that there's so much about the stage show that's exactly the same as it was 50 years ago. You know, it's still that rapport between the audience and the group. And it's still that immediate thing, you know. Whereas in the studio, it couldn't be more different. You know, it's everything's digital now, and so I've had a chance to see all the changes over the last 50 years in the studio. So you know, going back from, you know, 4-track days to you know, Pro Tools,
yeah,
and all the digital workstations and all the fun things you can do. We would have killed for this technology 40 and 50 years ago.
Oh, absolutely! You can imagine how much more useful what we have today would have been back then.
Absolutely, and of course then too, you know, you push a button and it goes out to every radio station.
Yeah,
in the world.
Mm-hmm.
By just pushing one button in the studio, as long as you have the stations. And so there's this great ability to communicate with the fans. Our website, of course, and Facebook, and all the stuff on YouTube. It's just really marvelous what's available today.
Absolutely. Now I'm going to put you on the spot with this next question, but out of all the songs you've done, which one is your favorite?
Wow, of the hits, you mean?
Of any of them, actually, whether it be a hit or...
Well, my favorite always ends up, you know, on the B-side of an album nobody's ever heard of. You know, I probably of the hits, I'd probably have to say Crystal Blue Persuasion.
Yeah.
Is the one that I like to play the most. It's just the one that, strangely enough, was one of the hardest records I ever made, because when we went in the studio with Crystal Blue, it was such a change for us. It was just... style-wise, it was just a real change, and we totally overproduced the record. And I'll never forget, you know, we had a full set of drums, we had you know, electric guitars, we had the, you know, everything going at once.
Yeah.
And when I listened to it, it just wasn't Crystal Blue anymore, and I realized we had to, you know, deproduce it, unproduce the record, and we had to start. We pulled out the drums, we pulled out all the electric guitars, we pulled out everything that was there, until all that was left was a bongo and a flamenco acoustic guitar and one rhythm guitar and the Hammond organ. And that was Crystal Blue. You know, it had to breathe.
Absolutely.
One of the toughest records we ever made. That's the one I enjoy playing the most. Moni Moni is the one probably that, you know, that is the... That's the song. There's no... The CO2 level goes up pretty high at that point.
Mine's, like, very hard, because there's so many of your songs that I really enjoy, so it's just so hard to, like, pick just one.
Well, thank you very much. Crimson and Clover is really fun to play on stage, too, but I'd have to say probably Crystal Blue is my favorite.
Mine's a toss-up. There's, like, 3 or 4 that I'm really big fans of, one of them being Crystal Blue Persuasion.
Uh-huh.
I've always been a fan of that one. I've always liked Moni Moni. Say I Am was one I just started listening to more recently when I was doing some research on you, and I really fell in love with it. And then also, I Think We're Alone Now is also up there towards the top of my list.
Thank you very much.
Now, my mother, her favorite has always been Crimson and Clover. Because that was the song that they ended every single dance with in grade school and high school.
Oh, is that right?
So that was always the grand finale. That's when you knew it was coming to an end.
Well, you know, and it's amazing how the music has stood up to time. It's never really come off the radio. They're always playing it somewhere.
Absolutely.
And I just am so flattered when we've had over 300 cover versions done of our songs. Just before he died, Prince did Crimson and Clover, a very futuristic version of Crimson and Clover that went number one on the Lotus Flower albums, first digital album that ever went number one. And then Dolly Parton did it. Dolly and I actually sang a duet of Crimson and Clover a couple of years ago. So and it's been so many songs. We've had over 300 cover versions done by artists from REM to the Boston Pops. You know, we've had 36 movies, and I just am amazed at how these songs have stayed in the public eye.
Absolutely. The best way to look at it is the good music truly never goes away.
Well, thank you. That's nice of you to say.
Absolutely. You've always been one of my all-time favorites. So this has been like a big pleasure on my part to be able to talk to you today.
Well, me too. Me too. Thank you very much.
No problem. We're getting close to the end of the interview, but I just have a few other things I'd like to bring up.
Sure.
What sort of advice would you have for younger people today looking to get into the music industry?
Yeah, right. I get asked that a lot, actually. Well, you know, it's interesting. There actually is a pretty good answer to that. It's very difficult, as you know, for young artists to get noticed today because there's so much talent out there, but also the record companies are really not getting behind the acts anymore. You have to come to them almost with a hit in hand to get signed with a label. And also, radio has gone through such changes. And although there's so many, you know, stations today, plus online radio and stuff, it's hard to get noticed. My best advice to a young band who writes music is to get, oh, I don't know, 8 or 10 of your best songs onto a CD, you know, demo them in some way, and take them, instead of to a record company, take them to a publishing company, one of the big publishers, EMI or Sony or Chapel or one of the big publishers, and because the publishing business is where the action is, it's where the money is, it's the ownership of the music, of the songs themselves. And then do a deal with a publisher for, oh, I don't know, split publishing with them, or even give them all of it, just so that you will have a partner with some clout. And then the publisher can open doors for an act that nobody else can. They can get your songs in movies, commercials, all kinds of stuff, or take it to a label. The publisher can have a lot better luck taking it to a label than you can as an independent. So I would definitely look up the various music publishers online that publish pop music, and then most of them are in New York, L.A., and Nashville, and then go there. Actually, go there with a demo tape or a demo CD of your songs, and sell yourself to a publisher before you go anywhere else.
That's great advice. Thank you for that.
Sure.
I'm going to circle back around to Moni Moni once again.
Okay.
Now, a lot of people have always wondered, who's the song named after? And it has an interesting backstory. I was hoping you'd be able to shed some light on that.
Sure. Well, you know, Moni Moni was really a track that we started when nobody else was doing party rock anymore. You know, I've always loved party rock, you know, just jamming live rock and roll. And in 68, everybody was too stoned to do party rock, you know. And, you know, everything was about the war and about everything else going on. So we just went in the studio and did this party rock track, and we had no name for it. And so we had written a song around the track, and we had all the lyrics, but we still had no title. And so Richie Cordell, my songwriting partner, and I, were up at my apartment in New York, and everything sounded so stupid. We're looking for a Sloopy or a Boney Maroney or something, and we went outside. We lit up a cigarette and looked on. We were out on the terrace at my apartment. We looked up into the night sky, and the first thing we see is the Mutual of New York Insurance Company sign. Had the time and the weather and big M-O-N-Y, just Moni, Moni, just flashed. And we just started to laugh because that was the perfect name for the record. And, you know, it was like God saying, here's the title. And so we just started to laugh, and we went and we just worked with it, and sure enough, it came out perfect. We needed a two-syllable word, and the next night we just called it Moni Moni in the studio, and that's one of those 60 stories that sounds like it was made up by a press agent, but it's the truth.
Oh, man. Every time I read that story, I always get a chuckle out of that because it's like you would never think.
Yes. Well, listen, we were always looking for titles.
Mm-hmm.
Always looking for, you know, a new song because our life had become one hit after another, and we were never comfortable until the next record was in the can, you know, that we were ready to release the next record. So we're constantly on the lookout for titles and interesting lyrics and names of girls for songs that were interesting and things like that. So, you know, Moni fit right into it all.
Absolutely. Now, when you're not busy touring and you're not busy making new music, what do you like to do to unwind?
Well, you know, the funny part is I'm on the road so much that I love my vacation to me is going home. And, you know, and not living out of a suitcase. My wife, Linda, and just hanging out at home. I'm a real homebody. I like to get out sometimes. I'll do horseback riding and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But mainly I just love to just be home. I live in New Jersey, and we got a beautiful place, and I'm really happy just to be home. So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Wonderful. What do you think your future holds?
Well, I've a few more records, I suppose. I don't know. You know, I just keep doing what I'm doing. I feel like, you know, it's possible I may get into the movie business producing. I never know. I love writing. We're writing a new comedy, a play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Wise Guys on Walkers. And it's a funny play. And we are in the middle of doing that right now. I don't know what's going to happen with it. We will sell it at some point. But all kinds of things like that. As long as it's creative and as long as I can mix it up with the fans.
All righty, there you go. Well, I'd love to talk to you for a lot more longer, but I've pretty much run out of questions for the time being.
I'm getting a little hoarse myself, yeah. Well, listen, it's been great talking with you. It really has.
Absolutely. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to hear before we wrap up?
Sure. Just, you know, if you want to come to our website, see where we're performing, just come out and see us. And thank you for all the attention and success over the years.
Well, wonderful. Tommy, thank you for joining us here today. And if
thank
you ever
want
to come back, we'd be glad to have you up here.
That sounds great. You take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Tommy James of the band Tommy James and the Shondells. We are now going to get back to the music. Here is Crimson and Clover by Tommy James on 91.5 WGLZ.